listener production.
We should increase the tax-free threshold to a number. I don't know what that is. Call it 45 grand. And Cam, don't kill me on the numbers. Mm-hmm. You'll have a better idea because you're the economist. Every dollar you receive, including a pension, would be taxable, right? But because the tax-free threshold might be, say, 45 grand, there's no tax payable on it. In retirement, I wouldn't have a 0% super. I'd still have the 15% taxation on all super earnings right through life and a payout, which would be taxed marginally. They're two very, very different answers. I wouldn't mind which one of them we go with.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips, the Chief Investment Officer of The Motley Fool, and welcome to The Good Oil. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the phrase, but giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff. And that's the aim of our podcast. We bring you conversations with entrepreneurs, executives, and experts, the people who know what's going on, and the people who make things happen. Now, I like to think today's guest is someone who really knows what's going on, because that guest is, well, me. In fact, we're bringing you an episode, part one, by the way, of a conversation I had on the Aussie Firebug podcast with Matt and with another guest, Dr. Cameron Murray, who, by the way, also definitely knows what's going on. We debated superannuation. We talked through what's happening with super at the moment, what should happen, how super might be improved. It's a really, really fun and fascinating conversation. I certainly learned a lot. I hope you will enjoy it too. So enjoy this conversation about superannuation.
MP Jim Chalmers, who is the current Treasurer of Australia in the Albanese's government, his team released a media publication last week where he proposed the objective of super be, and I quote, to preserve savings to deliver income for a dignified retirement alongside government support in an equitable and sustainable way, end quote.
I think the description, to answer your direct question, I think we should talk about Cam's point, by the way, but to answer your direct question, I think that Chalmers' definition is a pretty good one of what we should want superannuation to be. There is a lot of loaded language. I've had arguments with people on Twitter already about exactly that. What does dignified mean? What is equitable? Then it gets to equity, then it gets to fairness, then it gets to communism. If you let it run off in a direction, it kind of goes for miles, right? So, but I think as much as those words are loaded, I actually think it's a pretty good definition. And by the way, there's going to be political stuff in this as well, right? So politics aside, and I've done a little bit on Twitter, not to give myself a rap or to get people to my Twitter account, but on kind of what I think, if you started from first principles, what would super look like? We'll get to that in a minute. But I think to your question directly, it's a very, very reasonable, decent way to define what you want super to be, leaving plenty of room for defining some of the terms that Chalmers used and putting some brackets around what is equitable, what is dignified, how much is required, how equitable, are we measuring outcomes or inputs, all that kind of stuff. And it's going to be a great conversation because I'm sure we'll get to some of those. But I think as a starting point, if you're going to say, irrespective of political views, current structure, any of that sort of stuff, how would you design a retirement income system? I think if you are asking people to save for their own retirement, which we do in the current structure, then I think that's a pretty good definition, yeah.
Yeah, I think Scott, that's the trick here, right? Are we defining a retirement income system, like a policy setting for the whole of Australia, or are we defining the purpose of one part of it that is, in my view, not very good at doing most of the things that sort of purpose would say? And that's where I think I really diverge, but probably from you and from a lot of people, is that if that's your ambition for a retirement income system, why would you have superannuation? Like, we have invented insurance. We've invented insurance for thousands of years where people pool their resources with other people for future, to cover future losses. And superannuation, the big issue with it for me is that it doesn't do that, right? And an individual, saving is just shifting income forward and backwards in time, and there's a limit to what any individual can do for that. And it's the same with health insurance. We don't go, oh, you must save in your own private health insurance account, if you have a heart attack at age 50 for surgery, because we know it doesn't work because you need to pull resources across people. So maybe that definition's really good as a retirement income system, as a policy, high level thing. But then I think the next step down is, well, how would you do that? And for me, it wouldn't be force people to save, especially people in their 20s whose incomes are probably the lowest in their lives and their expenses are possibly the highest. to save for some future point where they're already insured in retirement through the pension when their income's probably going to be higher. So anyway, that's sort of a bit of context and big picture from me. And I'm not sure if you agree with that, Scott.
It's great. So I think you and I will agree on a lot, but actually probably end up in opposite positions at the end, ironically, which is kind of just a, and it's kind of ideology. It's kind of like, you know, what's the role of society? What's the role of the individual? And there's kind of a lot of ideology there. I'm no hard right winger. I'm no, you know, free market capitalism. I'm a fair market, well-regulated capitalism guy. So a couple of quick things. I think my starting point is, and it's kind of, it's the mirror image of insurance, not in terms of the opposite, but a different way of doing the same thing. My starting point, two thoughts, is I would start with, I think it's very, very fair and reasonable for those who are able, and it's effectively most of us with superannuation, to make provision for our own retirement rather than relying on the taxation revenue of future generations. Now, to be fair, I'm paying for my super and for my parents and grandparents. They're not alive, but you know, I mean, I'm paying for older people's non-super right now. But as a transitionary mechanism, I think having a society where my working life has put aside funds for my retirement makes more sense than asking a future generation to pay for those. So I'd say that. I think the other thing on how you would structure this is I've made some other suggestions, by the way, about how that might work. In fact, we'll get to this later, I suppose. But I would make an investment at birth because your point about the 20s, while it's absolutely right, Cam, and I agree 100%, it also takes advantage of, as the fire guys will know, and as you will know, it takes advantage of the extra couple of decades of compounding. So the amount of saving you have to do to catch up in your 40s and 50s, if you are going to say, and I know you don't necessarily agree with the premise, which is cool, but if you're going to say we are going to, compulsorily or otherwise, save for our own retirement, then starting in your 20s, the value of that over the couple of decades you don't wait is multiples more than if you had. So I don't mind starting at that point. We get no opportunity cost and what else could the money be used for sure. And we'll probably go to some of that stuff, but I have no issue making it compulsory. I have no issue starting at the 20s. As I said, I would put aside 10 grand per person at birth and then effectively let that compound for 70 years rather than waiting until you're 20 and then slowly building that up. And you actually save a whole lot of stuff, which is a massive tangent. I don't know if you want to go there just yet, but there are other ways I would solve the saving for retirement problem, which I think is more efficient and effective and less of a drag, but that's a whole different conversation for another time or for later in the podcast.
Can I just butt in? I'll let you respond.
What do you think you are, the host of this podcast or something? We're having a conversation here.
I just want to set the context because maybe some people out there listening, we've gone into another topic and I want to go back to super eventually. No, this is great. I maybe should have started here, but I want to give the context for the listeners. So Cam, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe just explain a little bit. You've written some material and you've published books. You're actually in favor of scrapping the super system. Like, I know we're talking about super at the moment, yeah, and we'll get back to super and the proposed changes, but maybe we should have started here.
Yeah.
You think super is inefficient and you wouldn't have the system. You'd have an alternative to the super system. So I just wanted to make that clear for the listeners.
So maybe it's also worth recapping what superannuation is. It's essentially compulsory savings program with tax advantages. So that's what it is. And every worker currently puts, I think it's up to 10%. It's ratcheting up from 9.5% to 12% of their salary. It's only for employees. So if you own a business, you don't have to put in anything. If you make income from dividends, you don't have to put any of that aside. You know, so it's not a taxable income. It's from employment income only. You have to put this money aside through your whole working life. So as a 17-year-old casual shelf stocker, at Woolworths, for some reason, the government thinks it's better for you to not have money now and have it, you know, maybe if you're still alive at age 60. So that's what the system is. And we throw a huge amount of tax advantages at it. And those tax advantages are skewed to the highest income earners, obviously, who can put the most in and who then have the highest balances in these investment accounts, who make the most returns and get tax advantaged as well. So, which brings me back to my original point about, well, the people who can save for retirement don't need any tax advantages or compulsion to do it, which is all super is. It's just tax advantages and compulsion for investment. And so the people who can most take advantage of this don't need that, right? So that's what it is. And so my position, essentially, in 2019, I did a big deep dive and I'm looking at all this data and I'm seeing, for example, that for the bottom third of households, when they age onto the age pension, they get a pay rise. Right. So the bottom third of households, when they're a year younger than the age pension age, which used to be 65, they're making less money than what they make when they turn 65 and get the age pension, right? So the question is, why would those people be forced to have less money now in super when they're going to have more money when they're on the age pension? And, you know, they're alive today, right? The probability of them aging, you know, every year, there's 10% or whatever the percent chance is that they don't survive the next year at those ages. So my only conclusion from looking at all that data and the skew of the tax advantages to those who don't need compulsion or tax advantages to save or invest led me to the conclusion that there's nothing being gained here. We should just give people their money back because the age pension's doing all the heavy lifting for retirement incomes, and all the superannuation system is doing is skewing tax advantages up the income distribution and amplifying the inequalities of working life in retirement. So, and if we did that by saving all those taxes, you'd have more revenue to be more generous with the age pension, potentially push the age back down from 67 to 65. You know, it was recently increased. And so that's where I'm coming from, is that I just, once you dig into the data there, and all the projections are that this system is not really taking people off the age pension because of that very reason, that those who can save don't need it and those who can't save don't benefit from it, right? So anyway, that's where I'm coming from.
And my only thought, so again, I think we're actually not miles away from each other in the way that it's implied. I think the only, well, not the only, maybe the major differentiator between Cameron and I is I think those criticisms are 100% valid. I think the challenge might be, what are the range of better options or better choices? One, to Cameron's point, is absolutely scrapping the whole lot. I have been very, very critical of the tax advantages, for example. So if we're saying, is the current system perfect? No. Should it be changed? Yes. I think we've got a unity ticket at that point.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
What is probably the more interesting conversation. So I think it's worth, and Cameron's not saying this, I don't want to put words in about that at all. You can speak for yourself, of course, Cam. But, I'm not saying he's necessarily wrong, but nor am I also saying that by saying I think super is useful and worthwhile and appropriate, that it should exist in its current form. I would go further, again, we might get this, than the current government is projecting. I have a range of improvements for superannuation, but I would keep it as a centerpiece in a vastly improved format. Cam would scrap it. I think it's right to look at the criticism and say, hang on, this feels pretty broken. Yep, we're 100% agreed. Then to what is also a really good conversation. I think that's where we differ. So we'll end up with, a lot of agreement, and then some potential changes where we say, actually, no, I have a different view for X, Y, Z reason.
So maybe I'm keen to hear what you think your ideal changes would be, Scott. Like, so if you were just Prime Minister for the day and everyone agreed, everyone in your party just agreed to go along with what you said.
Yes.
You know, polling be damned. So you'd obviously, so currently you can just keep piling money into your fund, right? And get up mm-hmm. to $10 million yeah. and get
or
tax advantages.
Yeah, exactly.
And the person with the biggest Yeah, the person with the biggest fund in Australia is $400 million in a tax advantage.
In fact, it's larger than that now, apparently. The most updated number is 540, I think, from memory. It's that account that's grown by 25%, right?
So this person is one of the top 10 richest people in the country. Not top 10, but it's quite likely they are. So, you know, we should just name those people until they give up and admit who it is.
I did think when I seen that figure, guys, I was like, if you're at that level of wealth, I thought there was better, like, you know, I just couldn't imagine someone had put it in super at that level of wealth. That was just insane to me.
It's pretty bloody tax effective, I've got to say. Like, yeah. I'm not sure it's the best option, but it's not a bad one at all. And this is, so Cam's point, that the taxation of this stuff is ridiculous. Now, we should say quickly, those rules have been changed, right? So you can't put that much in anymore, but the combination of intended and unintended consequences of previous government rule changes have allowed that to be the case. There are now maximum caps on contributions and a whole lot of other stuff that means you couldn't do it today, but it's been grandfathered. I think I like Cameron's example of pull a billionaires in a classroom and don't let them go to lunch after the bell rings until someone acknowledges who it was. It's back, you know, right, until someone owns up, you're all staying here, you're on the tension. So if you're okay with you, I'll answer Cam's question in terms of the solutions. Is that okay?
Up to you. Yeah, Cam, did you have something to finish?
No. I'm keen to hear, because, you know, Scott's one of the most reasonable voices on this, so I'm keen to really see how close we can get with his solution.
Sure.
And then whether he can convince me not to just get rid of the whole that. Yeah, because I think, you know, we do agree on a lot, and it's very rare in this circumstance. If you've seen the press in the last few weeks, everybody's just losing their mind. Everyone with over $3 million in super has decided they're just a hardworking one
average Australian. Yeah,
you know, just one bad decision away from living in a cardboard box on the street or something.
Exactly. We're taking their money, Cam. We're taking their money.
What is the percentage of Australians with a balance over 3 million? It surely couldn't be much of the populace.
I've heard reported 116,000 accounts is what I've heard reported. I can't qualify that number myself. I haven't done the work.
So there's about 14 million Aussies in the workforce would have a super account. So and plus some retired. So about 1%.
Two-thirds of 1%, something like that. Yeah.
Quick math.
Very quick.
Scott.
Someone will check me. The problem being it's been recorded. Someone will go, no, it's not even close to that. All right. So I have two opposing thoughts as to how we can fix superannuation. I don't want to make this about me, by the way, so I want to make sure Cam has enough time to jump in. My starting point is, as I said before, the principle is I would rather save for my retirement, have my peers and my own age save for our own retirements rather than ask our kids to fund that through taxation revenue at some future point. So that's my very, very starting point. And if you start from there and you say, okay, some sort of retirement savings scheme is attractive, again, these are layering assumptions here, there's two different solutions. One is a very, very, very simple long-term solution, which is if you believe in the power of compound returns and you think that capitalism is not going to die in the next X years between the kid who's born tomorrow morning and their 65th or 67th or 70th birthday, whatever the retirement age is by then, you can put a very, very small amount of money in absolute and relative terms aside for that child, which would compound at reasonably decent historic rates to be pension-ish, super-ish levels by retirement. Now that number could be as low, depending on your assumptions, as $4,000, or as high as about $20,000. And that's a big range, right? For some people listening, it's like that's a massive range. But at birth, funded potentially by government, frankly, and then put aside and left in a individual or even pooled, to Cam's original point, pooled account, so that at retirement age, whatever that is, the money would have compounded over that time. It saves the average employee, and I've done these numbers for a while. The average employee the employer on behalf of the employee, assuming no concessional contributions, will contribute something like $350,000 to super on behalf of their employee during that person's working life, compared to somewhere between $4,000 and $20,000 at birth. Now, there are inflationary, CPI indexing we should do to those numbers, but as an idea, that's a very, very attractive starting point for me. So that's my first idea, really super simple. The money is there, the money comes out. It needs to be managed in retirement. By the way, different thing. I'd also I'd limit the amount of money people could take out of super every year, so I don't take the lump sum out, blow it on, exciting things, and then get another pension. So that's different again. So that's the first idea. Second idea is taking the current system and just, can I read this very quickly? It's not too boring. It's not too long. But I wrote it, and it's kind of just because it summarizes my thoughts nicely. So I said, here we go. Starting with the status quo on super is the wrong framing for a principal discussion. Framing matters. Super was designed to relieve pressure on retirement funding, not as a wealth creation or an estate planning tool. Logically, it makes sense to incentivize saving and investing to build a large enough nest egg to deliver pension replacing income, plus a little more for the vagaries and risks of investing, and to recognize the money was quarantined during their working lives. Keeping with that logic, concessionary taxation should cease at a level of both contribution and income or withdrawal that exceeds that level. Because after that point, the cost of super exceeds that of the pension it seeks to replace. It's also why we shouldn't focus, in my view, on the fund balance, but rather the size of the income stream and tax that income accordingly. So what I would do is I would simply allocate tax advantage on accumulation during our working lives. I think that makes sense because we want people to generate those nest eggs. Again, assuming you take my starting assumption of saving for our own retirement. Once you retire and start drawing an income stream, my personal view, I would make all retirement income, let's say 65, let's give Cam his 2 years back of retirement age and say it's 65.
Yay.
At 65, we should increase the tax-free threshold to a number. I don't know what that is. Call it $45,000. And Cam, don't kill me on the numbers. Mm-hmm. You have a better idea because you're the economist. Call it $45,000. Every dollar you receive, including, this is going to be a bit random too, including a pension, would be taxable. Right. But because the tax-free threshold might be, say, $45,000, there's no tax payable on it. Every hour you wanted to work in retirement, you could do. And again, it would be taxable when you earn more than that threshold. So it doesn't mean people get penalized for re-entering the workforce, losing the pension, losing healthcare cards, whatever. And superannuation payments would equally be taxable on the same basis. So every year you would declare your entire income, pension plus work plus super, and that gets taxed at a marginal tax rate of 15, 30, 45%, potentially higher at that person of $510 million. That's a different conversation. I would simply make it marginally taxable. I think you would take away 90% of the superannuation regulation. You wouldn't have an accumulation account and a pension account. You wouldn't have some cap that somehow, how do you mandate a cap? Do you make people take out the difference? I don't know what you do. So I think it's a politician and bureaucratic answer. You mentioned the polls before, Cam. If I didn't have to worry about the polls, this is easy. If I had to worry about the polls, it's harder. But I would simply tax all income marginally with a higher than working age tax-free threshold to allow for you want them to get some of that tax money or the super money tax-free. By the way, and then in retirement, I wouldn't have a 0% super. I'd still have the 15% taxation on all super earnings right through life and a payout, which would be taxed marginally. So they're two very, very different answers. I wouldn't mind which one of them we go with.
So can I just ask one more clarifying question, Scott, about your ideal system?
Go on. Yeah, go on.
So this compulsory savings, when can you start withdrawing it? So one of the big bizarre elements of the system we have is that you can withdraw your super at age, well, it's incrementing up from age 57 to age 60, but you can't get an age pension until you're 67 now. So you've got this, it was like 9 years before the age pension age. Now it's going to be 7 years before. And you've got this huge incentive to actually work less and retire earlier.
Right.
Because the super system age that you can access this money is lower. So, you know, if everyone's working less and retiring earlier, that shrinks the size of the economy and makes it more difficult to look after the non-workers, right? So it's doing the exact opposite of what we think our retirement income system could do. So if you've paid any attention to the debates about aging and all these old people not working, our super system makes more not so old people stop working. Right. And the huge incentive in the system is to take all of your money at 57 or 60, whatever the number is today, because it's ratcheting up. Go on a trip around Australia, buy a Land Cruiser, fix your house,
and then
get the age pension. Yep. And, my parents have just gone through this age pension age period, and everybody's all about getting the age pension. Like, you know, so essentially the whole system has all these huge tax breaks for people who don't need them so that people who are 60 can go on a driving holiday around Australia and get the age pension anyway. And there's nothing stopping this, right? One other issue that comes up a lot is people with all this in their 60s, there's all these financial scams and whatnot they get caught up with because they've all of a sudden got this huge amount of super that they can access and everybody's willing to sell them the next financial scam. So anyway, what are your thoughts on the age? If in an ideal compulsory saving system, is the age the same? And what's your general view? Sorry for taking over the hosting, Matt.
I'm loving it.
Well, let's know when you need it, Matt.
Your sort of view on, so we've ratcheted up the age pension age. Now, I think that's kind of silly because, as you've already said, Scott, you can have an age pension and people working at the same time. There's no issue with that. Yeah, so your thoughts on the age of super and age pension?
So I think the easy answer is they should be the same. I think you can, though, modify them in two different ways. The first is if you mandate the maximum withdrawal, then it puts less pressure on the buyer land cruiser to go on the pension thing. So it may not be an age that's required. It may be a maximum withdrawal per year or per year at certain ages. So you might say up until 67, you can take out 1% of your fund, and then at 67, it's 2%. Or yeah, you may be able to do it without doing it by age. Because I think there is some benefit. If I had $84 million in super because I'd invested well, right? Let's put aside caps and contributions. Let's just say I've contributed normally and invested really well. I've got $84 million. At 60, if I don't see the benefit, as long as if I could guarantee you that I was never going to use the pension because I have enough money in super, denying me access to it also seems a little bit counterproductive because there's no societal benefit to that denying. So there's that. And I think the other thing, by the way, we should, it's probably a bit big for this podcast, but there's a labor force question, right, of with unemployment now at 3.4%, everyone who wants a job generally can get one with massive exceptions, but let's go with that. At some point when unemployment's 8%, making people stay in the workforce because they can't get super, who would otherwise take the super versus someone who wants a job and can't get it because the old person's in the job. I want old people to be able to keep working. I think we should be ageist about it in either direction.
Yes.
So I wouldn't necessarily mandate I think it would be, you could do it by direct age. And if you're going to do it by age, it should be equal. I think there's no justification for it to be different. With the exception that I think you could say to someone with enough means, you may withdraw X percent of your superannuation from age, whatever. I don't know what that age is, by the way. Because I have a guarantee by virtue of the structure of your super fund, you couldn't possibly take it all out because I'm limiting you to X percent of the value. So again, that's not popular. I wouldn't get voted in doing it. It'd have to be the the autocratic president of Australia to get away with that. But that's what I would
do. Yes. Okay. So I'm going to respond to some of the first things you said. I know you've got a list of questions here, Matt, but I think we're doing it just a bit out of order.
Just roll with it, guys. Keep going. It's great.
So I think one of the fundamental disagreements we have about the need for this is this idea of compounding returns, right? That somehow we are paying twice for retirement. And for me, that is a huge myth, right? Because if I buy BHP shares and in retirement, I live off the dividends or the sale, that money I'm spending in retirement was the money from the buyers of iron ore, right? And the buyers of my shares that I'm selling to them. So they are transferring me their resources when I retire via this financial system instead of retransferring the resources via the tax system. So there's no sort of time travel involved here, right? That's my big thing. So if we can support people with a super system when they're retired and say, hey, the super's going to allow us to look after these old people, well, the tax system can allow us to as well, because the economy is big enough. We have the resources. It's just the method by which we transfer those resources to those people who don't have them. And remember, super doesn't really transfer anything unless you've already got the economic means. So it's not really doing a lot. So that's another way to make that same point is that, yes, investments in asset markets compound over time. Tax revenue and the size of the economy also compounds over time, right? So those benefits of compound interest exist in the economy as a whole in general. And hence, you know, if we can support people in retirement through one means, we can support them through the other. There's only, as I like to say, there can be only one, right? There can be only one.
He is the Highlander, Matt. We know that we've just found out.
It's my Highlander take on retirement. There is only one system, and that transfers resources to retired people when they need it. So the car they buy, the food they drink, the services they get, they all are produced at the time. We're not stocking up cans of baked beans and cans of fuel in the garage for the car. We're not consuming today's resources in the future. What we're doing is we're transferring future resources from the economy as a whole, from others, at the time they're needed. So that's, I think, a fundamental part of perhaps why we still disagree at the obvious conclusion that we don't need any of this pre-funding. Because, for example, that $10,000 you give every child in this account when they retire, you can just transfer the money into their account when they retire at the time of the amount you want them to have at the age you want them to have it. You don't need to have that account the whole way through. That doesn't do anything, because all you're doing is swapping money. You're just basically swapping who owns, you know, BHP shares and who owns a bank deposit at time zero when you're born. And that doesn't change anything about the macro economy, right? You're just saying, okay, we're going to make this account. You own BHP shares. Here, I'll give you cash. You have my shares. Okay, now somehow we're compounding and making the economy better in the future. So I think that's a big difference. And the other thing I wanted to pick up on about compulsory savings as a system in general is that, you know, the economically optimal way to smooth consumption over your lifetime, and that's what we're all about here, right? We're smoothing consumption over lifetimes, because we think that when people are children, they don't have any money, so we need to give parents money for children. When people are retired, they don't have any money. Well, some don't. So we need to give those some who don't have money, money, right? Because they're the low points of your life. But in reality, okay, the low points of your life probably these days go up to your 30s. So I wrote an article last year comparing essentially my situation with two young kids in my 20s and my household after-tax income, like my disposable income, as a renter household, age 28, with two children. And I'm like, the retirees have way more money. Retirees who own their own home, they have way more money than I do. Why am I giving up 10% of my income? And of course, I was working for university, so I was giving up 17% of my income. And I'm sitting here thinking, hang on, the government is paying me parenting payments because they think I'm too poor. And they're also saying, you're too rich. We need to have some of your money so you can have it later when you're actually richer than you are now. So the economically optimal way to smooth consumption is essentially borrow like crazy when you're young, spend every single dollar plus more. Then when you're in your 40s, 50s and 60s, highest income years, pretty much save 50% of what you earn and then spend it later, right? But what we're doing is we're really depressing those early years of your life, the incomes of young people, right, who are already going to be richer when they retire for no particular reason, just because we have pretended that we want some type of accounting system for our retirement fund that keeps everyone happy politically. We've essentially made every Australian age under 30 poor because it makes us feel good and pretend that we've got savings. And that for me is like, you know, it's scary how powerful that is, because at the end of the day, we're not about, you know, life is not about, as you say, Matt, you know, it's not about how much is in your bank. It's about having a good life and being flexible because you've got secure income, right? And you've got lots of options. So you're 20 something renting household. I have this fictitious person in my mind. You've just had twins. You're age 24. Okay. You're slaving away. You're an apprentice of some sort. And everyone's like, yeah, man, you've got too much money. We're going to take 10% because the guys who are selling you BHP shares, they need the money, not you. And I just think that's like so insulting, you know. So anyway, that's my rant about income smoothing. And just to finish on a little agreement with Scott, I think it's New Zealand that has a universal pension at age 65, which is a pay-as-you-go taxpayer-funded pension where you can work on that pension and not have any tax effects. So New Zealand, you know, has a pretty decent, I don't even think we need that level to improve on having super. I think getting rid of InSuper is a net improvement without changing our age pension system. But if you also reduce the qualifying age and tweak some of those work incentives, like Scott was mentioning, so that if you are on the pension and work, you don't like lose a lot of your income, you know. But again, if we're going to raise that issue, I tell you what, if you have three kids and a low income, sometimes you're paying 100%. You can earn $20,000 extra and get nothing extra in your bank account. So that's a general design issue of our taxes and welfare system, which I think everyone would agree we need to fix. But I think it's just become a priority right now because we're talking about super.
It is stupid how badly broken. David Plunkett on Twitter, for those who are on Twitter.
Oh, he's great.
He's got some fantastic graphs of what happens to your disposable income depending on your circumstances in terms of, you know, parenting payments coming in and out, you know, family tax benefit, AB, all that sort of stuff. Some of those graphs that show you how absolutely stupid, like mindlessly banal the tax system is. And these are smart people designing this stuff, right? At least in Treasury. They'll probably send it, break it, and then unbreak it and break it again. And that's what I'm saying. You know, whether we end up fixing or scrapping super, I think we can at least agree, and I think we are largely agreeing at 75% plus of this, which is just, hey, the system's fundamentally stupid. Let's actually fix it so it works in favor of society in a much better way. The honest thing, the big question here, the big, you know, unanswered one is someone loses, right? Someone's paying more tax for some of this stuff to happen.
Yes.
And that's not unreasonable. I'm a capitalist, I'm an investor. A lot of my members want me to make them as much money as physically possible, and a decent subset of those would say, and I'd like to pay less tax, please. And I get to, because I'm just fortunate in the job I've got, to say, I hear you. I don't have to just, you know, fight your corner because I'm your representative for better or worse. I get to say, actually, policy-wise, there's some really, really screwy, terrible policies out there that just do not work the way they should. And there are some people, newsflash, who should pay more tax. And that's really politically unpopular, again, to Cam's point. Some guts in Canberra, bipartisan guts preferably, to say, hey, this doesn't work, let's fix it. Never going to happen, right? But that is part of it, is absolutely the structure of the tax system. You fix some of that stuff, including, I agree with you. I actually found out about New Zealand, Cam, only 2 or 3 days ago. I should have known more about New Zealand, but I didn't. To that point, a universal pension, it's effectively a UBI, which is, again, a whole different conversation, universal basic income. But a universal pension with a marginal taxation system for additional revenue over and above that solves a very large chunk of these problems. And it's not even difficult, right? Imagine how much super stuff you could take away. If you said no caps, no separate pension account, no zero tax in retirement, you know, no assets testing, pension testing, means testing for some of these benefits, because everyone gets the pension. And now there are people who say, hang on, that's just, you know, people say about early childhood education, that's just, you know, middle class, upper class welfare. I think we can say something's universal. I think primary education should be universal. I think early childhood education should be universal. And I think it's reasonable to say a pension should be universal, above which you then pay marginal rates of tax up to 45%. Not this ridiculous 0% up to 1.7 million and then 15% above that.
Yeah, I just want to wrap up the point that we're going to just let's wrap up on this agreement that I fear the direction we're going with super. So back to reality land now, not our ideal worlds. Back in reality, I fear that instead of simplifying all these ways that we suggest doing, simplifying the age pension, simplifying super, reducing the administrative burden to get a better system, we're going to go the other way. And we're going to basically do a make work exercise for financial managers and tax accountants. And that should really be top of mind for all the policy people involved. And I think we agree on that.
1,000%.
I was going to bring something like that up, Cam, because I know where you sit, Cam. You've written literature, I've read it, Scrapping the System. It was quite eye-opening for me because I'd never really seen that point of view. Super, to me, I mean, it makes so much sense. Your point before, Scott, with putting $4,000 away for every child, whatever it was, $10,000, and letting it compound until they reach their preservation age. That makes so much sense in my mind. I don't know. I know, you know, you've got different opinions, Cameron, but just logically, I'm like, that. Why isn't every country doing that? But here's the thing I wanted to bring up, and I think I know Cam's point of view, but I'm interested to hear yours, Scott. By the way, New Zealand have the KiwiSaver as well. I just wanted to mention that.
Yes, they do.
So they've got like a similar thing to the super, right? It's not just this pension system.
Both is fine, by the way. Pam probably doesn't agree. I think we can do both. I think that's but the point is you tax it appropriately so that anyone earning extra income just pays tax on it.
Yeah, so KiwiSaver is voluntary though, right?
Is it? Okay, I didn't know that. It's voluntary. Okay, so here's the thing, right? Because I think the crux of the argument is, do we actually need both? Now, I know where Cam sits on this. He would say scrap super. And this is my question to you, Scott. The pension, to my knowledge, is pretty good in Australia. I mean, I just Googled it. It's what, for a couple combined, $1,500 per fortnight. Now, if we make a few assumptions there, like and the main one being, I guess, is do you own your own home outright? I don't know the data, and maybe Cam, step in whenever you want to tell me, or maybe you know Scott as well. But if you're 65, 60, whatever it is, you're not going to be spending as much. I know the peak income years are between like 30 and 45 or something. And that's when you're spending the most. When you have children, you're paying for school, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to get a bigger house. So is it not reasonable that most Australians can live a pretty decent life on the combined pension? And therefore, do we actually need a whole nother system? I know there's going to be edge cases. There's going to be exceptions to that rule. But to me, it just seems like I'm not fully educated on this topic to know exactly the answer to this, but once I read Cam's, I'm like, yeah, why do we actually need a whole nother super system? And Cam's point as well is part of your money, 10%, is going to this fund that you can access when you reach your preservation age, when a lot of people could use that money in their 30s and 40s. Scott.
So we get into values pretty quickly, and we get into behavioral versus theoretical, and so it gets messy real fast. I think the pension is a very good base level of retirement income.
And we all agree we need the pension. I think we're all in agreement. Like, the pensions are fantastic.
Yes, yeah. But so when I say pretty good, I mean I'm talking about the level of it, not whether it should be delivered or not. I don't think the pension is as high as a society we should aspire to for a standard of living in retirement. For a couple of reasons. Now, I'm not going to go into housing because, frankly, we need to fix housing, and I'm sure we could have another conversation for another hour and a half on housing. We can't assume people own their own homes, which is crazy to me that you can now – banks are offering now 40-year mortgages, right? So let's put that aside. $1,500 a fortnight is a decent, good, acceptable level of retirement income. Maybe it's my capitalist tendencies, but I would aspire to, for everybody in the country, to have a retirement income which was – a more, to use Jim Chalmers, a dignified level of income. I don't think there's no pensioners out there having a whale of a time, right? That they are subsisting, they're doing okay. It probably hasn't kept up with price inflation, as we well know. So whether we increase the pension itself or whether we have a supplementary system, and again, Cam would say the former, I would say the latter. But I'm not here to defend super in and of itself. I could probably be persuaded, or I wouldn't hate it if we said actually let's have $45,000 a year pension. I'd probably, well, okay, now we're starting to talk about something similar. So maybe it's the level of the pension or level of retirement income is, again, to Cam's original point, what we're discussing here. But again, remember, the size of the supplementary super needn't be huge because I would not provide concessional taxation on contributions over a certain amount. I wouldn't allow zero taxation in retirement. So what I'm saying is that the super would be a supplementary system on top of a moderate pension, which I think is something we could or should aspire to. So my mother's retired. She's 73. She should get that right, shouldn't I? I think pension is okay, but I got to say, I would like to think people on pension would have more money in retirement, not so they can afford the, everyone gets a $200,000 Land Cruiser and goes around the country to Cam's point. But so there's more than just subsistence. Thanks for working. Here's just enough to keep you alive for the rest of your lives. And I think my key difference with Cam a little bit is, while you're right about the higher income levels, mate, in terms of people saving, we also know from experience in Australia pre-super and around the world, circumstantially and behaviourally, people don't tend to. And I think there is, let's use the word nanny state or paternalistic, call it what you want, there is an element of me saying, actually, I know what we will do as a group. I did economics at school, right? I didn't say start saving properly independently of super till I was 26. And I rue those missing 7 or 8 years because I know the value of compounding over that time. I knew the answers. Did I do it? No. I've got family who wouldn't be doing it now if super didn't exist. I think it is a really, really handy behavioral nudge, to use that overused word. It's not really a nudge, it's a compulsion, but you know what I mean? To actually achieve some of that stuff. So, you know, behaviorally, we wouldn't. Some will, the top echelon will. I would hazard a guess that the average Australian in, say, 30 years when super's been going long enough to be a full workforce, the average Australian will retire with a better lifestyle than they would have had super not existed. And if that's our fundamental starting point, and you guys might disagree, which is cool, go for it. If that's your fundamental starting point, then I think super's proved its use as a compulsory system. Again, not defending the tax breaks, not defending anything. Like, I'm not saying we should keep what it is. I'm saying as a structural concept, compulsory saving for retirement, I think will show itself to have been worthwhile, albeit it was bastardized along the way and people took advantage of it and the tax system was robbed of hundreds of millions, billions of dollars maybe over that life of rightful tax revenues. So it's true that it's imperfect, vastly imperfect, but I also think we'd end up with a better retirement standard of living with super than without it.
Can I just say one thing, Cam? Can you talk about, because this is a really important topic in this whole debate, the super industry is massive. And I think in your literature and your writings, you talk about how it's close. There is the number of people working in the super industry is as much as the Australian Defence Force or something like that. And to me, that blows my mind. I think that's just a really good point to bring up, Cam.
Yeah. So the question, so there's a couple of things that just came up. One is, will future retirees be better off than today? I would like that to be the case, full stop, if society is progressing, right? Like, if we have degraded as a society that we can't improve the lives of aged pensioners over the next decades, despite becoming wealthier, then, you know, that's a bit of a sad political environment to live in.
Which is almost my point, Cam, unfortunately. That's literally almost my problem.
Yeah, so your point is, but I think it's probably one of the big divides is that there's, you know, and you see this in the commentary on super, it's like, you can't trust the future government, right? You know, you can't trust them to look after pensioners. Now, I think that's overblown because people over 67 are just still growing as a voting cohort, right? And you put the age pension up a couple of years, you get voted out like the Labor Party did. And I think that's just a quick sidetrack, make sure I get back onto what I was going to say. The Labor Party, we've got this complete reversal politically. We've got the Labor Party ratcheting up the pension age to kick people off the pension and privatizing retirement in some of the world's most expensive fund managers with the tax breaks to the highest income. That's our left-wing party in Australia, right? Yeah. And we've got our right-wing party basically saying, hey,
defending utes,
what a
weekend.
Great game. Can my mates at my banks please come and play as well, right? And we've got no one there going, hey, you know people who are working? You know those people? Sometimes they need their money when they're working, right? Do we not care about young people? So I think, you know, partly the debate is symptomatic of just, you know, we're all getting old and richer, older people are getting more powerful voices. And have I heard anything about 20-something-year-old families in the super debate? Because they're paying 10% of their income at their lowest income points in their life with their highest expenses of their whole lives, supporting 4 or 5 people in one household. Absolute silence, because that's the flip side of super. Is that those people are having a worse quality of life today. So yes, we should increase the quality of life for aged pensioners, but I think that's true also of working people as well. And that's, you know, so that's the flip side of that. You know, anyone can spend 20% of their income in their 20s, 30s and 40s and have a lot of money in retirement. You've just wasted your life, right? And of course, you know, 5% of you died before you got your money as well, right? So that's another thing we don't think about is people all don't die at the same time. still 1 in 6 men will die before they get the age pension. So super did nothing for them, and probably 1 in 10 die before they get the super. So it basically just stole their money in a way, made their lives worse on balance. So any net benefit calculation you want to do for these systems has to take your thing and multiply by 0.9 for the age pension, 0.83 for the whatever those factors are, because people die at different points. So Scott's other point was, you know, there's some value judgment here. And I think at the end of the day, all of these economic debates come down to value judgments. And it's probably easier for us because we predominantly agree on some of these key issues. But here's a statement. People should spend their money. Money is for spending, right? Like, that is the whole point of being a wealthy economy, is people can spend money. Right. So this whole, you know, the idea that people won't save for retirement, I say, yeah, why would they? Right. Remember, the bottom third of people, when they get the age pension, it's a pay rise for them. So this, it's stupid for them. Right. It's completely nonsense. For the next sort of third of households, you know, it's 50-50, doesn't really matter. Some of them are going to save. And the top 30%, it doesn't matter anyway, because they're independently wealthy their whole working lives. So I just don't see that there is a sort of moral value to not spending your money while you're alive and have high expenses. So I've got two kids at high school, right? And I'm sitting here going, oh, I'm worried about the future, this and that. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, I could die in 5 years, right? Why would I not spend everything I can today to have the best life possible? And so it makes perfect sense to me. And remember, you know, we don't need this sort of moral virtue of saving if we ensure as a collective in the age pension system, which we do, right? Because this system will automatically tax and redistribute those with wealth and with high incomes, and even those on middle incomes, and even working, you know, young people. It will automatically do the job for you without having to sort of, you know, have this moral debate at all about what's good, what's bad. Is it moral to save? Is it thriftiness a virtue? It doesn't matter. We're just all insured automatically. You know, when I buy my car insurance, it works. I do it because it works. And yet we're here when it comes to retirement going, oh yeah, we should definitely not insure. We should definitely not pool the risks. We should definitely do this other thing. I'm like, what? It just blows my mind. It makes no sense. And to finish, you know, if we want to tie retirement incomes to working life incomes, right? If we want people who earn more during their working life to have more in retirement, which we might do as a, you know, social objective, you can also tie the pension to previous earnings as well, right? So some countries in retirement go, you know, you get 70% of your average income of the last 10 years of your working life, and then it goes down to 50%, right? Until the minimum. So you could do that as well. And that system as a whole would be far more efficient in terms of resources, in terms of those 45,000 spreadsheet monkeys, you know, trying to second guess each other, with which way Apple shares are going to go, or whether Bitcoin's the future.
It's a lot of people. It's a lot of people to be working in the system.
And just remember, the superannuation system as a whole lost 20% of its value after the financial crisis, right? So it's not like it's, a bit tangential and a final point. We're sort of tying our whole social welfare system to these financial markets, and then that becomes a huge incentive to politically sort of give advantages to financial operators, because then they can go, hey, this is your savings. We need more of this. We need this. So you're sort of politically hitching your ride to essentially all these financial scammers and whatnot.
I know you're going to jump in, Matt. Let me very quickly just say, from a fund management perspective, I actually agree with you both. My default fund would be a version of the super, the future fund. So I think, again, it's one of those questions of, do we need a ditch super because there's 45,000 spreadsheet monkeys? I don't think so. I think we should have 3 spreadsheet monkeys at the future fund investing in ETFs. And then if people want to separate out, they can do that. But I think part of the, again, we agree on the problem. I think there are a range of solutions which go from as it is to get rid of super. To my view, default fund would just be a future fund as the government default, probably not the super fund itself, or maybe, doesn't really matter, but I would invest in ETFs, super low cost. Your cost would be a tiny fraction of a percentage of 1%.
Yeah, I was going to quickly say, Cam, and I'll just butt in. I'll give you the last word. I'll give the last word, Cam, but we'll move on after I give you the last word, because I'm on my first question. We're going to have to split this podcast into two parts.
We've answered the last 3 already, Matt. I'm looking here. We took it upon ourselves to do it in reverse.
We'll go back. But I was going to say just quickly that I think that is a really good point, Scott, you made. I think we all agree on this. To have 45,000 Australians working in this industry, I just feel like that is so much of the economy or so much
human capital.
That's the word I'm looking for. Human capital
tied up in this. Right?
Yes. Exactly. It just seems so simple that you're putting 45,000 people to do what exactly? And some of these funds are charging ridiculous fees. Like there is some gouging going on and some BS happening in this industry that makes it very inefficient.
But it's not only gouging, right? It's the duplication that's the problem. So the gouging is real, don't get me wrong. But the profit margins of these guys aren't spectacular. You know, Magellan's lost $1 squillion recently. So part of it's absolutely gouging. And retail funds are terrible. And everyone should be an industry fund. I can't give personal advice, yep, but just be an industry fund if you're going to. But it's a duplication. So of the 45,000 spreadsheet monkeys, 10,000 is any one point in time are looking at BHP, right? And so it's not just the gouging. And they've got bills to pay and they've got families. So it's not a dead loss to the economy because they're employed doing a thing and that's worth something. But in terms of productivity as economically, both the gouging and the duplication could be removed really quickly. I'm going to shut up now, Matt. You can ask questions.
No, you're right. And I think, Scott, you'd probably agree that the more rules we make, the more compliance requirements on these funds. Yeah, and so they're all crazy. Just, you've got this array of people checking on other people to check on this, to check on some more paperwork, to liaise with the legal department and then liaise with the tax office. And you know, that just breeds a whole bureaucratic industry. So we mentioned it before. We've got to go the opposite direction on terms of rules.
And by the way, 3/4 of people with SMSF shouldn't have them. So that would also take a whole lot of costs out, which is, again, a whole different conversation, but it's part of that duplication problem.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.